Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. The Texas we find in books and movies has certainly shaped our sense of the state. But do those icons still have the same power? For some 30 years, Don Graham has taught the famous course Life and Literature of the Southwest at UT Austin. The course was originally created by J. Frank Dobie, the pioneering Texas folklorist. In those years, Graham has written two books on Hollywood's treatment of Texas, and as a writer at large for Texas Monthly, he's often riled up readers with his dryly funny takes on Cormac McCarthy appearing on Oprah, and the repeated failure of The Alamo to become a decent movie. Graham has just released his second collection of essays about Texas literature called State of Minds. Don, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jerome.
You begin this new collection with the interesting observation that probably no other state honors its writers the way Texas does. There are statues to some of them in Austin and elsewhere. We have the Texas Book Festival, the Texas Institute of Letters, and quite a few centers dedicated to Texas studies. But why do we?
Because I don't know whether it's out of some kind of defensive reaction against negative views of Texas and Texas culture coming from around the country. I don't know. Maybe it's part of that pride that a lot of Texans feel about everything having to do with the state. I do know that it really got started, this whole thing got started 75 years ago, back in 1936 with the when the Texas Centennial was held in Dallas, and there were people like J. Frank Dobie and others who thought the celebration was entirely about our material bounty, agricultural production, et cetera. So they wanted to maintain or make the claim that Texas was also a place of literary culture, literary writing, literary works. And so they formed the Texas Institute of Letters. That's about the early. There were reading clubs all through the state, though, before that. But that's the first, I believe, kind of official attempt to make this claim.
So you think that the statues that you mentioned came out of Dobie's quest to have Texas literature accepted as worthy of study and teaching?
Yeah, Dobie is absolutely crucial because. There's a famous story in 1929 when he was teaching at the University of Texas. He proposed to the English department to teach a course called Literature of the Southwest. And the people in the English department said, the professor said, there is no literature of the Southwest. And so he said, well, there's plenty of life. I'll teach that. And so he named the course Life and Lit. And then over the years, Dobie made a number of statements in his essays about the importance of studying regional culture, and he has this great line about the mesquite is as worthy of celebration as the Greek acanthus. So what he called for, I mean, even if you never read a line of Dobie, or you read him and you don't really respond to him, Dobie was absolutely crucial because he was all over the place. He was in the newspaper. He was publishing books. He was giving talks all the time. And he was promoting the idea that the Southwest had its own authentic history, art. He didn't get into paintings much, but he focused on literature. And I can't think of anybody. I mean, Dobie was, without Dobie, I don't know when that course would have been invented.
I have to ask, because you never really explained it in the book, why in the world does the SeaWorld in San Antonio have a statue of Catherine Ann Porter?
Well, I actually know the answer to that. It's because Harcourt Brace originally financed that SeaWorld. I don't know if they still own it or not. And Harcourt Brace was a publisher of KAP. And KAP went to school in San Antonio for about a year, and it is very funny. I'm glad you brought that up. That one usually gets overlooked.
Speaking of Dobie, I couldn't help notice that in State of Minds you continue your attempt to reassert the importance of cotton and of East Texas in general in Texas history and culture against the dominating presence of the West Texas icons. And it's like something of a running argument against J. Frank Dobie. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, that's one of the central ironies, I think, of my work in this field, is that I'm from McCollum County, just north of where you are, northeast of where you are, and there in Dallas. And it was all cotton culture, and we were indistinguishable from ways of being in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, et cetera. And over at Archer City, there was McMurtry over there about, I don't know what the distance is from Lucas to Archer City, maybe 100 miles, something like that. And there, he lived in completely in Dobie country and ranching country and so on. And I've said this on more than one occasion that Dobie and Betacek and Webb, those three iconic figures, they had absolutely no interest in East Texas. They had no interest in anything east of I-35. And I always thought Dobie would find it ironic that I wound up teaching the course, that I came from a cotton farm, which he's on record as having hated.
People like Edward Everett Davis, in his novel *The White Scourge*, called cotton culture a great open-air slum.
Didn't
he have a point? I mean, it gave us the plantation system and tenant farming, and perhaps replacing that industry with British petroleum wasn't a tremendous advance. But you yourself admit, when you're talking about you growing up there, that you lasted one day chopping cotton.
Well, that was later, after I'd moved away from there. But no, it was a difficult kind of life, but there were many, many good things about rural culture. I mean, in my childhood, maybe I was just lucky, but I had a very good childhood. And there were people in that community who remained in Lucas and are still there, and who made good livings out of farming. But those people had a lot of acreage. There's no question that the tenant farming, my father wasn't a tenant farmer, but he wasn't far off from that, that was a culture produced grinding, often it produced grinding poverty, and it was a very difficult, demanding way of life. Being a poor old cowboy out in West Texas wasn't much different, except they got to ride horses, and we didn't have any horses, and there was something always kind of romantic about the idea of having that kind of mobility and that kind of lifestyle. But the work could be, it was hard physical labor in either case. But my point is, there was nothing romantic about following a mule, which my father was plowing with when I was born. He didn't get the John Deere tractor until a bit later.
So that what you're saying is that entire industry, that entire world, pretty much doesn't exist when people speak of Texas. You could drive this whole neighborhood in North Texas and never see anything remaining of it except the Cotton Bowl.
That's right. That's about it. Yeah, and mechanization replaced the need, the need for cotton pickers, those small farms couldn't hold on. During that drought, during the 1950s, that took care of a lot of them, took care of a lot of ranchers, too. Anyway, what I argue is that Dallas came out there and just claimed all that land, and it was all sold for development, and lots of people live out there.
In your 2004 anthology, Lone Star Literature, you deliberately did not include Edna Ferber's novel Giant. You reread it, you said, and only to rediscover how bad it is. I mention this because later this year, the Dallas Theater Center will present a new musical adaptation of Giant with some notable Broadway talent involved. The movie was a different matter, though, wasn't it? Before Lonesome Dove came along, Giant was kind of Texas' own Gone with the Wind, wasn't it?
Yeah, Giant is really, I would say it's certainly the single most important film about Texas. I think it's a really good film, and one of the things that I do in my current classes the last few years is I have them see Giant, because like out of 50 people, one has seen the film, And there's a whole bunch of students who see it, and they can't believe how, I mean, it becomes one of their all-time favorite movies. So it was really, really important. Now, the funny thing about her book is that her book was published, I think, in 52, and then the film was made in 55. But the Texans hated her book. It got roundly, badly reviewed throughout the state. But the feeling was that they're not going to like the movie, but Texans embraced the movie. It was a kind of, it had that kind of sweep and grandeur that Gone with the Wind had.
It also it also cut out a lot of Ferber's acid satire.
Yeah, and a lot of Ferber stuff. It's funny how that stuff persists. She has in there stuff like that Texans fly around the state all the time. They go, you know, if they live in San Antonio, they go to lunch in El Paso because they all have planes and they're all rich and so on. And she talks about how far they would travel to eat barbecue and so on. And I found this very funny because Calvin Trillin has wrote a piece for Texas Monthly, and he said, this was like last year or the year before, he said that Texans routinely drive 50 miles, will drive 50 miles for lunch at a barbecue place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anybody that does that except Calvin Trillin.
Well, I have a plane, don't you?
Yeah, sure. Also, yeah, and I have my own oil well to take care of the. Yeah, right. We've got all that stuff.
Okay, good. You cite repeatedly in throughout the various essays in this book the how so much of this is being forgotten, partly because things like Dallas suburbs wipe out a lot of the cotton industry, the culture that take it over. But also you repeatedly cite the fact that your students come in and they know less and less of Texas literature, less and less even of Texas, of Western movies. But would it be so bad if we forgot the Alamo? I'm playing devil's advocate here, so people don't grab your cell phones. But but it, in a sense, a lot of that, I mean, people already have forgotten cotton culture, and it dominated this state for decades.
Right.
And plenty of states do just fine without the kind of what may be a confining set of myths and battles. And, I mean, they can be heroic models, but at the same time, I think we've all gone through the experience, as we just did, of telling people, no, I don't have an oil well, no, I don't know cowboys, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So would it be so bad if a lot of this was forgotten?
Oh, I don't know that whether it would be bad or not, really. All I know is that my students, I think that they get interested in this material pretty quickly. And a lot of them they already have instilled in them from whatever source, I don't know, some kind of sense of pride at living in Texas. Now, there are a lot of people that, you know, very critical of Texas in many, many respects. But most of my students feel pretty good about where they live. And this simply enriches their understanding by connecting them with the past. Now, I don't spend any time on the Alamo, just as an example, the way I get to the history is through the books and the literature. Now I could pick a book, a novel about the Alamo, but I never have. I talk more about the. Now this is an example. I teach a recent book. He's not a Texan. A guy named Adam Braver who wrote a book called November 22nd, 1963, and all of us, you know, who were going about our lives at that time, that made an indelible mark on us. And this book brings that alive for them in a way that they don't get in their history classes in high school, or maybe they just get a paragraph about it or something, and they don't have any of those emotions or any connection with that whole event. Mm-hmm. And they get very caught up in that, simply in the detail. Same thing when I teach the gay place that deals with Lyndon Johnson. So my own view is if I went to live in Nebraska, what I would do when I got there is I would ask somebody, although I already know, I would ask them, say,
Don,
what are the essential books about Nebraska that I should read?
Don, I'm going to have to take a break right now. We'll get back to Nebraska books in a minute.
Gotcha.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1.
Thank you.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
I'm Jerome Weeks. This is THINK. I'm filling in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking with Texas literature and film scholar Don Graham. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. And Don, you were just talking about teaching your students, exposing them to books about Texas and how they responded to that.
Yeah. And I was just saying, making the point that if I had to move to Nebraska, I would want to read the major Nebraska writers, and that'd be Willa Cather and Wright Morris, among others. I'm sure there's some other books I just don't know. When I went to Australia, I did the same thing, fell in love with Australian writing, and everybody says, oh, is there Australian writing? Well, there is. Anyway, my point is I'm a reader. I've always been a reader. From growing up from a young age, as soon as I learned how to read, that became one of the central activities of my entire life, one of the most enjoyable and one of the most valuable. And that's what I try to get across to these students. And one of the things that they really like about it is that they're reading books that they like a lot and that they haven't been hammered with over the head since high school or before that, and about which there's often not very much published criticism. So there's not this big tradition. I mean, they can approach these works fresh, kind of on their own terms.
Somewhat surprisingly for an Austin academic, you're a big fan, a defender of the TV show Dallas. I mean, you have fun mocking the mistakes it makes, like that little hurricane that hit Dallas.
Right.
Yet you make the case, perhaps a little tongue-in-cheek, that not having visited the city at all actually helped the creator, David Jacobs, develop the series.
Yeah, it's. I just think it's funny that he didn't know anything about the place.
And was convinced not to come here to do
right,
research.
Exactly. And then I think it's doubly funny when he came here, he said, everybody, you know, he saw everybody in cowboy hats and boots and stuff like that, which I don't believe he did see. Mm. You could find that, I guess, in parts of Dallas, but Dallas certainly has never struck me as being a Western-type city.
Mm. Well, why do you defend it? You call it a great soap opera.
Well, soap operas is, you know, that's a genre. That's that's not a genre I spend a lot of time with, but... I was really trying to talk, I think, more about its impact around the world. That at one time it was playing in 80 countries, serialized everywhere, and I was trying to account for why it was so popular, and putting forth various ideas that other people have mentioned. And I, you know, when it was on, I had a friend who was a Shakespearean scholar, an older fella, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he absolutely loved the show. He saw every episode of it. He had never been to Texas. He didn't know anything about, what Dallas is really like or what that landscape is like. And I watched most of those episodes. I didn't watch the other soap operas much during that. A flush soap opera period of the 80s, late 70s and 80s. But I was just, by that time, I was kind of tracking popular culture, TV culture, with reference to Texas, because I was just trying to cover the whole territory. I don't know. Oh, I know. The other thing, the funny thing was, is that when I was a kid, we used to go to Parker, which was just a wide spot in the road. I think there was a church there and maybe one store. And Parker is where South Fork is. And so to me, it was always funny that Collin County was cotton country, not cattle country. And then when they came in here with Dallas, they redefined it as, you know, West Texas.
This icon, yes.
With a southern-style house.
Mm-hmm.
Plantation House.
Let's go to Joan in Dallas. She has a comment about the TV show and Dallas history. Joan?
I think it's really interesting how that show and other things have changed the culture here, because I grew up here. I'm like a sixth-generation Texan. We were never, ever in this area into country music. We were never into any cowboy history. We knew the history, but we were not cowboys. And then people moved in and thought they had to run out and buy boots and listen to George Jones. And we never did that. We were Beatles, Rolling Stones. You know, that was our culture growing up.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's exactly right. And in my high school in the 50s, what we listened to was KLIF playing kind of unknown, at that time unknown, black blues and what was going to be called rock and roll. And that was the music that we didn't pay any attention to country music either. And as a matter of fact, country music was denigrated. It was called hillbilly music in those days. And she's exactly right. I think the two things that probably contributed to that more than anything else, well, movies like Giant, everybody in Giant wears boots and so on and is a cowboy. But Urban Cowboy, 1980, and Dallas started in 1978, those two had enormous impact. And a lot of people rushed out and bought some expensive cowboy boots that didn't quite fit. after Urban Cowboy.
I read that in the 50s and 60s, and long before that, that you couldn't get a good job in Dallas in a bank, an insurance company, wearing Western wear.
I expect that's right, yeah. No, Dallas was, if you go back and look at the way people are dressed at the time of the assassination, I bet you can't spot a cowboy anywhere in that crowd.
Yeah, you're right. It's when you see old photos of Dallas, it's often surprising how much clothing people are wearing. But it could be a street in Chicago for most.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, my father and the that generation in Collin County, if anybody walked around in fancy boots, they'd have laughed at him. They'd have called him a drugstore cowboy.
Getting back to Dallas, the TV show, for a moment, you you present three theories about that attempt to explain its worldwide appeal. I was in Europe the summer of Who Shot JR, and I couldn't get away from it. I mean, people were continually grabbing me and wanting to talk about it.
There you go.
In France and in London, it's all they wanted to talk about. So, could you let us hear the three explanations of why this happened, why it took off?
Well, I'm not sure I can remember the three.
Well, one of them was James Wolcott. I remember that.
James Wolcott. Yeah, James Wolcott. I had another theory in there, that I cut out because it seemed a little dated. But my own view of it was that everybody loved JR because he got away, you know, he got away with murder, sexually at any rate. the actor whose name Larry Hagman just took that role and made it great. The other thing about it was that it played upon. Well, I mean, I can't remember exactly what these other guys' approaches, but it was about oil men and Texans. Apparently have some kind of complicated view of oil men. The rest of the country doesn't. The rest of the country just hates oil men, basically. And so Hagman was somebody you could both hate and then secretly like. I think a lot of men liked it because he got away with everything. And he was rich. He could do whatever he wanted to. And he was kind of laying the groundwork for somebody like Jerry Jones.
Yeah.
When Jerry Jones came and took the Cowboys, I thought, well, Jet Rink from Giant is still going strong.
Yeah. You also make the point towards the end of your essay on Dallas that you don't think it could happen again. Not that someone could actually reduplicate the success, but that some TV show about Texas could have the same iconic status.
You You know, I don't know. It's, you never say never in the world of TV, but I'll give you an example. One of the things I said at the end of that I thought turned out to be kind of funny was that I couldn't imagine a story about a lusty family that owns wind turbines out
right,
in West Texas.
Right.
And then I'll be damned if they didn't make a show, although it folded after two episodes, called Lone Star. And I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I did. I saw it.
And it was about wind farms. Yeah.
It wasn't bad, actually.
No, that was it was really, really good. And then, boom, it went. It was
that
dead.
Was one of the surprises, is that the generally it was reviewed very well, but no one watched it.
No, no one watched it. And I thought it was very clever and extremely watchable. And I can't explain it. Now, Friday Night Lights has been a big success, but I never have seen any real mythic resonance going on in that.
No, just the connection with Texas and football in general, I think,
right,
but nothing
right.
in particular with the show.
What you're asking is there going to be something equivalent to Dallas or Lonesome Dove? I guess.
Right, right. I guess it's like, is there a new myth that can?
Yeah. I don't know about the new myth. I will tell you where all the great stories in Texas are, and nobody's writing about them. Nobody's developing them, and I don't know why. They're all in South Texas, both history and current stuff. One of the puzzles to me is why some show that captures Hispanic Texas, why it's never been developed, never taken off. It's never been developed. Hollywood just doesn't look in that direction.
Hmm. Talking about essentially the immigration that's transforming the southern portions of Texas, California.
Yeah, yeah, and the demographics are very clear that the Hispanic population will be the dominant one within, 20 years, 30 mm-hmm. years, something like that. So eventually that may happen. I'll tell you a great film that nobody saw that deals with this is Tommy Lee Jones's The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada.
Right.
And almost no one's seen that movie. It's a great, great film, in my opinion.
Before we leave the conversation about Dallas, I want to go to a listener, Jim in Dallas. Jim?
On the air?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That was quick. I thought you might enjoy this little story. I was... hired by a company that bought South Fork Ranch to use it as a tourist attraction back in the 80s. And I was a chef out there for a little event they put on at the house. And I was astounded as I stood in the kitchen and the tourists from all over the world surrounded the kitchen out on the outside looking in and heard everybody say, "There's JR's chef." One woman banged on the window and asked me to come out and sign her tourist book. So it was hilarious. The imagination of these people was astounding.
So you had your little moment of fame. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very funny.
By the way, one of the explanations for the worldwide appeal was a very odd one in a way. Wolcott was talking about it as being a kind of substitute for the Kennedy clan.
Bob. Yeah, I know he was trying to make that claim that the show came on that week of the assassination and so on.
Yeah,
and the guy's named Bobby.
Right, and there's Who Shot JR was
who shot
JFK.
JR, and that was. They were banking on that connection. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting idea, but I thought it didn't explain the appeal so much.
Right.
And we have another caller, Thomas from Dallas. Thomas, you're on the air.
Yeah, you were talking about the Hispanic heritage, and I just wanted to point out something we don't necessarily think about is Texas is two states. We had the Mexican-dominated areas of Austin and San Antonio where slavery was never allowed, and the black populations there are small, and they have, venerable Hispanic populations there, whereas Houston and Dallas are much more southern towns. We had slaves and that whole culture, and the Hispanic culture is much smaller and is now growing. But it's an interesting difference. I haven't really seen anybody exploit or discuss much.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. But then, if you think about it, in terms of movies and books and so on, we really don't have. There are very, very few African-American writers, very few explorations of slavery in, except by some historians, of slavery in Texas. Texas had about as high a percentage of slave owners as any of the southern states did.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Got an interesting email message here from Travis Carr. What about King of the Hill, he asks.
Yeah, you know, I'm just not an animation type guy, but I know that I've seen some episodes of it, and I know that that guy, Mike Judge, was quite clever, and I know it hit upon quite a few Texas motifs, and again, I know that it was very popular with a lot of people.
I think, in a way, I'm not a huge fan of the show, although I've enjoyed it, but I think, in a way, it addresses one of those fundamental issues facing Texas artists, Texas writers. If you don't deal with the myths, if you don't deal with the stereotypes, what makes this place any different? I mean, if you have a John Updike of Collin County, how are you different from John Updike of Connecticut? And King of the Hill pretty much made suburbia, in a way, gave it a real Texas feel, a Texas approach.
Yeah, and part of it was the accents of some of those characters, too.
Yeah, the very flat kind of quality to it.
Right, that kind of nasality, particularly one of those real slim characters. I can't remember his name.
Oh, and then Boomhauer keeps mumbling.
Yeah, his lips don't move. Right.
I was just thinking that in terms of representations of cotton country, one of the very few films, and I don't think you mentioned this, is Places in the Heart.
Yeah, Places in the Heart, right.
It's about the only one that I can think of cotton country in Texas at all.
Well, there are, let's see, I think you might be right.
I mean, there have been obviously film representations of cotton plantations otherwise, but in terms of like sharecropping, tenant farming, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, there's an older film called The Southerner based on
right.
A book that I talk about, George Stacy Perry's Hold Autumn in Your Hand. But they never mentioned Texas in the film. And when you see it, you think it's not Texas. You think it's, Alabama or something.
Right.
That's what happens. Anything that deals with East Texas gets interpreted as Southern.
Right. Well,
unless they transform East Texas into the West.
Ah.
Which they do.
Well, we'll be getting back to talking with Don Graham about Texas literature in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think, and we're talking about Texas literature and Texas films with Don Graham. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. Sorry, 1-800-933-5372, or email us at think@kera.org. A little more background on Don for those people who might be unfamiliar with him. I can recommend the reading State of Minds in an earlier collection called Giant Country. And he has also edited the Lone Star Literature Anthology. It came out a number of years ago. I can go all the way back and recommend Cowboys and Cadillacs, his book on Texas movies from 1983. So that's going back a ways. But they're all very enjoyable to read. And we're going to go to the very patient Maureen from Austin. Maureen?
Hi, this is Maureen. I just wanted to just sort of, when you were talking about the world's or people's perceptions of Texas from people who don't live here, I had an incident when I was in England many years ago, and I was at a pub, and when someone found out I was from Texas, they asked, so what do you do in Texas other than murder presidents?
Yes.
Wonderful.
That's one of the things that people often cite about the TV show Dallas, is that for many people it kind of replaced that as the prime memory, the prime thing that people know about the city. But you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that and I was just going back and looking at what I'd said, because I said I couldn't remember it. And Walcott kind of quotes that guy we mentioned, mm-hmm. The connection with the Kennedy assassination, that episode. And that episode aired on November 21, so that's part of his argument.
Thank you very much. And we'll go to Chris in Arlington. Chris?
Hello, I was in talking to a lady that lives in Mansfield, an elderly lady, and she told me that the cotton gin that was in the little town between Arlington and Mansfield called Webb, that in the early 1900s, they co-opted that cotton gin, and that's where the word co-op came from. Does your author know anything about that?
No, I've never heard that, but she might well be right. I don't know.
It was the Granger family's cotton gin, and
they were named Granger?
Yeah, I believe they were named Granger. The lady I was speaking with, that was her last name, and she said it was her great-great-grandfather that owned the cotton gin there. It was sharecropped. Most places were sharecropped in Texas for years, but a desperate situation, I suppose, made them co-op the cotton gin to the community, and that's where the word co-op started.
Could well be.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don, you grew up pretty much around a cotton gin, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a cotton gin in Lucas, and my dad worked at it. And, yeah, I remember going down there. That's where all these old men hung out, and where they torment young boys like me.
In your introduction, you refer to this new collection, State of Minds, as a bookend to Giant Country, which came out in 1998. Does that mean you're done with essay collections on Texas?
No, I'm not. I don't know. I'm going to my next Texas-based project will be narrative history of some kind or another. Mm-hmm. And anthologies, I have to say this. I mean, this anthology could have been, this collection, it's not an anthology, mm-hmm. this collection could have been twice as long. But the problem now is with pricing. If you get, you know, if you double the number of pages, the price is going to put it out of the market, really. And I think this one, I like the economy in terms of number of pages of this collection. So I really had to go through and think about what I was going to include, what I wasn't. There were some I really wanted to include, but in the end, this is what I wound up with.
Let's go now to Emily in Dallas with a question about Anglo writers. Emily? Emily, are you there?
I'm sorry.
Emily?
I was calling KERA.
Yes, you are. You're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yes, you are.
My name's Claire. I work with the theater folks here in Dallas and Fort Worth. And when they were talking about there being no East Texas literature, I just wanted to point out the playwright Horton Foote, that we're doing a citywide, two citywide art festival, who talks about East Texas and the cotton culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Horton puts an excellent example, and I didn't mean to imply that there's no literature in East Texas. There's some very good writers. Horton Foote's one of them. There are three others that should be mentioned, William Owens, William mm-hmm. Humphrey. They're all named William. Three mm-hmm. of them are William Humphrey and William Goyen, and there are a bunch of others. But my point is that they get overlooked in favor of people like McMurtry and Cormac McCarthy and Elmer Kelton and John Graves, all those people writing about West Texas.
Maybe the Horton Foote Festival will help with that.
Could
thanks
be.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. It's It's going on. It's starting this week, and it's the largest collective effort of the theaters in North Texas, and with the SMU's DeGolyer Library, where the Horton Foote papers are. There's going to be an exhibition of his work. So it's going to run for like 6 weeks.
Wow.
It's pretty impressive. 17 arts organizations all involved in presenting plays, one acts, and screenings of his films, Tender Mercies.
Tender Mercies, one of the really good films.
Yes, it is. At any rate, so you were saying that you are not done with essay collections. I'm happy to hear that, because I was worried that perhaps you were I noticed that you were returning to things you've repeatedly written about, like Last Picture Show, for instance.
Right.
And I was worried that perhaps you felt you had said everything you could about that.
No, the thing is that it's a lot of these came about because I had a market for them, which was Texas Monthly, under Evan Smith's editorship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exactly the same now. I mean, editors change their focus, or you know how that
goes.
Right. And so I don't have a regular outlet. And besides that, I'm working on another book. So mm-hmm. the essays come when they come.
Mm-hmm. The essays in State of Minds often have little afterwards, and frequently it's a kind of response to angry readers.
Right.
I was wondering about that, particularly the Cormac McCarthy appearance on Oprah seemed to get a particularly vehement response, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
You mean it got a response from other people?
Yeah, but also your response to Cormac McCarthy's appearance on Oprah.
Right. Well, I thought it was funny, and I thought the whole thing was extremely boring. I don't know if you saw it or not.
I saw a bit of it.
Yeah. I thought it was incredibly boring, and I'm a huge admirer of Cormac's writing, and I just thought that really ultimately we don't really need to know anything about the writer. The writers often are not interesting.
Or they're an embarrassment to their work.
You're right. They're not interesting in and of themselves. And I know tons of writers, and many of them are as dull as dishwater. But the book's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I know why Cormac did it. He did it for the money. Mm-hmm. He did it, you know, and I'd go on there tomorrow. Because you make a lot of money if you get on the... You get on Oprah.
But people seem to think that you were reviling a saint or something.
Oh, they did. There were three essays in there that just got vitriolic attacks on me personally, and I just thought they were funny. But the Cormac one got a lot of angry letters addressed to me, no question about it.
And let's go to Deborah. From Blue Ridge. Deborah, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're on the air.
Am I too loud?
No, you're fine. Thank you.
Okay, I'm standing out in the wind, so I'm going to get in a corner here. Well, let's see, my accent, I'm up from Ardmore, but I really grew up over by East Texas, so, you know, all around this area. But back to Dallas, and my question's not so... wonderful as some of the others. But that Larry Hagman that played JR, you know, he's from right around here. So he had that part down. And he did a lot of coaching on everybody else. So that's why, one of the reasons why some of it was so dang good. And another reason is I'm that age. Well, it was nice to have something kind of racy, because everybody was ready for racy. We were just leftover flower kids, and we wanted something racy, and that was about as racy as it got, and fun, you know, and whatever. And I heard that over in the Orient, it's still popular as it can be. And the funny thing about out there at Southport, because I used to go out that way, like you say, out at Parker all the time, is that the way the shots make it look humongous.
Right.
And it's just now it looks like itty-bitty because all the suburbs have grown up around it. So, you know, they just gave people what they wanted to see, a little bit of oil and cattle and everything mixed and cowboys and took off. So I thought it was fun, and I thought Larry Hagman was a hoot. Anyway, thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, Deborah.
That was a great rundown on why the show was popular.
Yeah.
Hagman, by the way, was from Weatherford.
Right. We have another question here from Shirley in Fort Worth. Shirley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And you had a question?
Yes, my question was, listening to some of the conversation, there was an indication that there has not been the presence of very much contribution from the Black American or sector in Texas. And I was wondering what your author thought about that and if he had any plans or projects to change that, to enlist the collections or thoughts of Black Americans who live in Texas. I am not a native Texan. I'm from Ohio, but I've been in Texas a long time, and I really think that that's an area that needs to be tapped.
Thank you very much. You included African Americans in your anthology, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And I would say that what she's describing is a very worthy project, but it sounds to me more like folklore or oral history than written literature. What I was talking about was the presence, the not very statistically significant presence of Black writers from Texas. There is a guy, by the way, that I that has written a little bit about Texas, Walter Mosley.
Mm.
I don't know if he's actually from Texas.
Yes, he is. His family basically migrated to California for the defense plans.
Okay.
So he has written occasionally. Some of his books are set in Texas.
Right. So there. I mean, he's one that should be mentioned. And then there are other writers who've written just a little bit about African American experience in Texas, but certainly, and there has been folkloric work done as well. But I mean, it's a great idea. I searched high and low for two anthologies that I put together, looking for. Trying to identify and find African American writers that I could include. So I might have overlooked somebody, but I certainly made an effort to include them.
Ironically, perhaps, maybe even sadly, the most famous account of life from an African American experience was John Howard Griffin's.
Yeah, John Howard Griffin. I did. Yeah,
Black like me.
The guy, John Howard Griffin, from that, you know, from North Texas, and he's the guy who underwent the skin treatments to darken his skin and traveled through the South, deep South, and had many scarifying experiences as a Black man. Passed himself off as Black in the late 1950s, and then published his book Black Like Me in 1961.
And it got very different responses, you said, from the white audiences
yeah.
and the Black audience.
But you know, that book sold 11 million copies.
Yeah, it's still selling. You still can find it in bookstores.
Right, right.
And
it's a very good. It was a very powerful book when I read it too.
I'm wondering, are you? Does anyone ever accuse you of becoming a grump now? Reading several of these essays in a row, you sounding a little cranky, picking on Annie Proulx for her accents in her books.
No, I just think that's ridiculous in the case of Annie Proulx. My impression is if you have opinions, and if it's all not, you know, if some of these opinions are kind of satirical or negative or whatever, then people construe that as grumpy. I don't consider myself a grumpy person.
I don't either. And that's, we'll have to wrap up now. Thanks for talking with us, Don.
Thanks. It was fun. You had great callers.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. At 12:59, you've tuned into your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and streaming
at KERA.org. Also, 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. Think continues on KERA 90.1.
I'm Jeff Whittington, up next on an archive edition of Think, Transcending Chronic Illness. We spent an hour last summer with Dr. Julian Seifter, who's a practicing physician, a medical professor at Harvard, and a type 1 diabetes patient. We talked to him about how the diagnosis of a long-term, potentially life-threatening illness can change lives almost overnight, and about some of the remarkable strategies he's learned from patients coming to terms with the realities of a chronic health problem. Our special archive conversation starts after the news from NPR.